Hello, I'm Mark DeLuzio. Over the past century, our constitutional republic, grounded in the rule of law, has been transformed into a tyrannical democracy, orchestrated by unelected bureaucrats and globalists. The Constitution is now treated as a suggestion, not the law of the land. Welcome to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God.
Hi, I'm Mark's co-host, Suzette Lawrence. Our intention is to explore the Constitution and discuss how our freedoms and constitutional rights are violated by those very politicians who took an oath on the Bible to uphold it. Learn how the Constitution is the solution to our country's problems. What do we need to do to restore our inalienable and enumerated rights? Class begins now.
Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence. How are you, Suzette?
I'm doing great, Mark. I'm excited about our topic today.
Hey, notice I didn't call you Christy.
I do. Thank you. We love Christy.
We love Christy. We do. But, you know, I do know who you are.
Well, thank you.
Again, Suzette and I met on the campaign trail and we became good friends and all that good stuff. And I got to know her background and her knowledge of so many different things. So I said, geez, you know, let's do this, you know, and here we are. And so this is episode 18. And we're going to talk about the constitutional clauses. But, you know, Suzette, there's so many that we can't talk about them all right now. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of them, right? And I got a list right here. Yeah.
You could talk about one of them for 3 weeks.
Well, you know, we can't go deep dive into one only, and maybe on some of the more critical ones, we will. Now, what I did here was I said, look, there's like five or six that I want to talk about today because they are relevant. They all are relevant, but relevant to today. And they are probably some of the more debated and controversial ones as well. All right. And by the way, a lot of the debates on these have gone way back to the founders. It's not like it's new, right?
Well, and when you listen to the arguments, you know, like if you go to different platforms where attorneys teach, they're either teaching law students or they're debating the clauses. They always bring up cases from like 1908, 1922, 1956. You know, these are deep rooted in the Constitution. So, and they've been argued and supported by that. So that's always the key, right? Is it constitutional?
Well, you're also going to see that there's an incredible amount of inconsistency in the courts as it relates to these. And then just because let's say a Supreme Court finds a ruling either way, there's no provision that forces people to follow it. You know, and there's so many examples like that, you know, and we'll get more into that some other day. But I'm going to talk about the Supremacy Clause, the General Welfare Clause, which is a real big deal. They're all big deals, of course. I'm going to talk also, Suzette, about the Take Care Clause. Everybody's like, well, what is that? Right. You'll find out. The Establishment and Free Exercise Clause, which has to do with religion. And the Eighth Amendment, there's really three clauses in the Eighth Amendment, but I'm going to talk in particular. There's a Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause. There is the Excessive Fine Clause is what I'm going to talk about. Okay. And then the other clause is the Excessive Bail Clause. So the Eighth Amendment has three clauses. Again, excessive bail, excessive fines, and cruel and unusual punishment. And I'm going to talk about the fines, the excessive fine clause, because it's related to this recent ruling with President Trump, $350 some odd million for basically doing nothing. And I'm going to talk about that because it'd be very interesting. When I got into this, it was very interesting what I found. And there's a lot of inconsistencies here, okay? And a lot of sleight of hands also. So we'll talk about that. Again, there's so many clauses, Suzette. I've got lists here of all of them. There's a Commerce Clause, which is kind of important. The Contracts Clause, the Natural Born Citizen Clause. I'm just reading some of them. The Full Faith and Credit Clause, the Guarantee Clause, the Oath and Affirmation. There's Free Speech Clause. There's Freedom of the Press Clause, Assembly, Petition, Search and Seizure, Right to Bear Arms, Double Jeopardy. I mean, they're all in here. Due process, right? There's a million of them. So we can't do them all in one setting. And so let's call this part one. Because I know there's some, well, I know there's some near and dear to your heart that you want to talk about, which you will. So maybe you do that in part two, part three, whatever we do. So I'm going to start talking about the constitutional clauses that I picked out. And the first one I told you was the Supremacy Clause. Now, what is that? The Supremacy Clause falls in Article 6, Clause 2. And it basically says, in no uncertain terms, federal law is the law of the land. And in no uncertain terms, it says state law cannot trump federal law. So federal law says X, you can't do Y in that regard, okay? So it is the law of the land. And there's some interesting words in the Supremacy Clause. Well, maybe I should first, read it, but the Supremacy Clause basically says the supreme law of the land, pursuant thereof. Okay, in other words, if there is a constitutional statute or a constitutional law passed by Congress, so what it says is it's the law of the land pursuant thereof. All right. Which means it's got to be constitutional.
It always has to be constitutional, or we're not talking. You know, it's not part of, if it's not part of the law, you can't be breaking it. You know.
Well, you know, the interesting thing too is that when way back at episode 6, we did the nullification episode,
mm-hmm.
and we also talked about the executive orders, right? In another one of those episodes, can't remember the number now, but the Supreme Court would rule an executive order unconstitutional if it was not pursuant thereof. Okay, it's really key words, right? So this pursuance thereof is a really big deal. Now that even gets debated by some legal, if you want to quote, I'm doing air quotes if you can't see, scholars, okay? And you got to remember,
there are people that have made it their life's work to do workarounds on the Constitution. And, you know, when you think of that in your own life, you know, like the things that we do just day in and day out to kind of get out of something, you know, without really hurting it or without saying it out loud. That's how I see a lot of these guys. They spend their life trying, their life's work is trying to undo the freedom of the people. You know, the Constitution protects the people's rights. It's not, doesn't protect the government. It limits the government. That's the whole point, you know, that we have freedom and that states have, and in the Supremacy Clause, one thing that I found very interesting is states have the right to make laws that govern that state.
That's right.
So they're not, you know, they can't make laws that govern the federal.
Or be in conflict with federal law. Right. Right.
All of the states. But you can have a state law, you know, mm-hmm. And the Supremacy Clause in this one case, and it was in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think, South Dakota versus Doyle. And it had to do with drinking. You know, they wanted to change the drinking age to under 21 and in South Dakota. And the federal government said, well, you can do that. And we can't force you not to do it, but we can compel you by withholding, say, 5% of your highway funds to repair your roads. So we can. How did they describe it? The federal government cannot compel states to participate in an activity. Generally, if the state is involved in an activity that the feds can regulate. So they can regulate, but they can't compel. Isn't that, does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, it does. And but the compelling part of this thing, yeah, it was deemed unconstitutional. That's that the government can't do, the federal government can't do that, but it happens all the time.
All the time.
Okay. And a matter of fact,
because of the money, because they're compelled, because the states are just like everybody else. They want the money. And so long as the federal government is spending, giving states money, and then the states are basically held hostage.
Well, this, that's my take. Now let's go back to a bigger picture here on this particular topic, okay? When you start talking about limited government, and Jefferson, I think, was the one that said that, you know, your freedom is, in a sense, inversely proportionate to the size of government, all right, of federal government. So when the government is allowed to withhold funds, I mean, it just happened a few weeks ago when Biden went out and said, we're not going to give any funding to school districts that have a rifle program. Believe it or not, there are still those out there, okay? Trump said it. I'm a big fan of Trump, okay? But he said the other day, we're going to hold back funding from schools who actually allow boys to play in women's sports. Okay? That's not the role of the federal government. Okay, so what happens?
We have Title IX. This is what I don't understand. Why are these issues not argued in using the cases that have already been proved? You know,
well, you're going to see when I get into some of this too, there's a lot of precedent, but it gets ignored in a lot of cases because they find one little twist that's different, right? So all I'm saying is that part of the Marxist agenda and the globalization of our country is to take away state lines. Okay, they want a stateless society, and the founders set these 50 states up for you to be able to make decisions as to where to live in that regard. Okay, so if you don't like whatever drinking laws in South Dakota, you can move to Michigan or whatever state, right? So, right. So the whole point here is that the more the federal government grows, and in a lot of cases it grows unconstitutionally through these agencies that we did an episode on, what I call the fourth branch of government, the less rights and freedoms we have at the local level. And so, you know, the whole thing was you're supposed to be able to control your school board at the local level, not some bureaucrat in, you know, 2,600 miles away in Washington that you don't even know. So they use this money to do that, but the Supremacy Clause. Now, here's the interesting part. Where does it say that if a president does not, I'm going to get into that another part of the Take Care Clause. Let me hold off on that because, you know, if a president doesn't think a law is constitutional, what do you do? The Take Care Clause. We'll talk about that. Now, one more thing about the Supremacy Clause is that it's a big debate, right, as to this gray area between state rights and federal rights. And as government grown over the years and as we expanded into areas that are outside the enumerated powers of Congress, which is Article 1, Section 8, there's 17, 18 enumerated powers of Congress. We now have encroached on creating federal law that you can argue is not pursuant thereof. Okay. And that's always a debate in courts. Now, a good example, though, is this. It is illegal at the federal level. It's illegal to smoke marijuana. Okay. Well, then why are all these states coming up with marijuana laws and allowing marijuana to be legal? Well, it's a very simple reason. Because the federal government does not have a constitutional right to set that law, a marijuana law. No matter how you feel about marijuana, it doesn't really matter. That's
right,
not the issue.
Right.
Okay. That's not the issue. So the states are saying, well, we're going to set our own marijuana laws because we know we're going to win in court because the federal government does not have a right to set those laws. And the federal government knows that. And that's why all these states are coming up with these marijuana laws. Okay. Now, there's a very good example where you can argue, well, the law of the land, supremacy clause, says the marijuana laws at the federal level are, in fact, law of the land. You got to abide by it. No, you don't, because it's not pursuant thereof.
And again, Mark, when you say pursuant thereof, you're talking about the constitutional constraints.
Well, is the marijuana law at the federal level constitutional? And the answer is no.
There you go.
So
anyway. It's always pursuant thereof is always, is it constitutional? Does it pursue?
Is it constitutional? Yes. Or is a law written by Congress under the 18 enumerated powers of Congress?
I remember when this was an issue, there was an organization called NORML, the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws. This was back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And back then the discussion was always, if the states legalize marijuana, they'll be able to tax it. And they'll do it when it makes sense for them, when they need the money. When they need the money, they're gonna legalize marijuana and tax it. And part of that thinking at the time, you know, for a small government person like myself, is, well, why don't you just have a grow your own clause where the state can say, if you grow X amount for yourself, then there's nothing illegal about that. You can do that. You know, you can't distribute it.
Right.
You know, you can't take it out of the state.
But even then, like Massachusetts has that law, you can grow your own, but they limit you as how much you can grow per person, per family. It's like, you know, they got their hands in it. Hey, by the way, the grow your own, you know, these laws that they're passing, Suzette, are just further encroaching on all of our rights.
It's not
stopping. Okay.
And I'm not pro-drug. You know, I'm a very anti-drug person.
Right.
But I know that, you know, so many people smoke marijuana. What are you going to do? Lock everybody up? We already lock more people up. We have more people imprisoned in this country than any other country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, it's...
And by the way, a lot of them are in there for drugs, too. That's a good percentage.
Yeah, it's like, instead of having rehabilitation, you know, where you, like real rehabilitation, like 5-year programs where they learn a skill and grow food and, you know, commit to this long-term rehabilitation, not a 30 days, as a friend of mine who's an alcoholic would say, the 30 day spin dry, you know, to satisfy a court or a job or something like that. But like,
you're going to find a little later in this episode, I'm going to talk about a drug violation and what happened to this individual, which is pretty interesting. So this feeds right to the general warfare clause. Okay. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. This is one of the 18 enumerated powers of Congress. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare. That's the key word right there, general welfare, of the United States. Okay? Now, by the way, there's another part of this that says Congress, when they do lay taxes, has to be in proportion to the population of the states. That got killed in the 16th Amendment when they decided to tax income. But anyway, we'll come back. That's another subject for another day. So in the enumerated powers, episode 5 that we did, we talked about, you know, the general welfare clause.
Mm-hmm.
And Alexander Hamilton and Madison were, you know, they were the two principals of the Federalist Papers. And remember, the Federalist Papers, along with John Jay, he was the third one, were articles, or I'm sorry, letters to the editor in New York newspapers to convince the state of New York to sign out to the Constitution. That's what the Federalist Papers were.
And they were signed with an alias, Plubius. So they didn't put their names on there, because at that time, writing those kinds of letters, I mean, You could have been hung.
Well, yeah. Well,
you know, if
I wasn't aware of that. That's something I have to look into. I wasn't aware of that. Well, the general welfare clause, Hamilton and Madison had big disagreements here. Okay, about this. Now, remember, Hamilton was a big government guy, and Madison and Jefferson. So you really got Hamilton and Adams on one side of the aisle, if you will, that were the big government. They want to expand federal government. Okay. And Madison, along with Monroe and Jefferson, were more limited government guys. Okay. Now the General Welfare Clause was meant, and this is still debated today. Okay. Was meant to mean the general welfare of our nation. And there's all kinds of writings with Jefferson and what have you. It does not mean general welfare for a state or for a province or for a city or for a
company?
Company or individual.
So when they talk now about, you know, we have to bomb country X for national security reasons, and it turns out that Conoco has a gas is in the case of Syria right now, I believe it's Conoco has an oil well there that's illegal. It's not a legal well, and it's being protected by U.S. military. And that it is very hidden. You're not going to hear about that in any legacy media company or publication. But that's a real thing. And so when they talk about like protecting national interests, oftentimes what they're talking about is protecting donor interest, not our national interest, the donor class who's contributing to these elections and these.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and again, this whole general welfare, you know, unfortunately our Civil Rights Act called this welfare. Okay. And, mm-hmm. and basically the founders, especially the people, the Jeffersons and the Madisons and what have you, said, taking money from Suzette and giving it to Mark for whatever reason. Okay. Is unconstitutional. I can't take money from you and give it to me as an individual. Now, I could take money from Suzette for the national interest, for example, building our military, okay? We have a national interest in that, okay? Even James Madison, who actually wrote the Constitution, said this, charity is no part of the legislative duty of the government, and the government being the federal government.
And it's not. Think of hospitals, Mark. Up until people started thinking about sick people as a profit center, mm-hmm. and insurance and pharmacy and all that, hospitals were built by churches. They were built by donations. Churches donated money. Think of all the hospitals we know that have, you know, like St. Anthony's, St. Luke's, the Episcopal Hospital, St. Jude's. These were you took care of the sick. And
we handled it.
Yeah, we were fine. And, you know, every doctor, my uncle was a doctor. And I know this from personal experience, that every physician expected to give away some care, period. You know, I mean, in the 1950s, if you broke your leg, it maybe cost $50. I'm not kidding. You know, so these were, nobody expected to make money on sick people. And they certainly were not committed to keeping them sick. They wanted them to get better. So it's... Well,
how many times have you... Yeah, no, and you could say that. People say, well, how is little Johnny going to get his brain surgery done today? You know, and you know, the one thing that you don't have a right to as an individual is to my money. Okay.
That's right. And, you can and, Yeah. You can give that off. And if you were really committed to it, I mean, how does this sound? And I'm just thinking of this as we're talking. If I wanted to, I'm the neurosurgeon and little Johnny needs brain surgery, but his parents don't have insurance. What if I donate that? I give him that, don't bill him, but I can take it off my taxes as a tax deductible.
Yeah, right now the law says you can't do that. Yeah, right.
But it should. Right. We should be able to do yeah. that.
If you don't want that. Hey, come on. The insurance companies don't want that.
If the hospital wants to donate, if the nurses, you will not go on to a surgical unit in a hospital
right.
or a medical unit on a hospital that would not be willing to take care of someone for free. And if you had the added incentive that in the same way that you bill insurance, you could get a tax deduction for that, then they would be doing it with a, you know.
And I think you know exactly why they wouldn't
like they were going to. They would do it without feeling like they were going to undo their hospital and end up shutting down because they're giving everything away, right?
But the powers that be, the insurance companies, everything else, all that stuff is counter to what you just said, is counter to you're taking money out of people's pocket when you do that, you know, and that's why these things don't happen. That's very logical, right? Well, here's the other thing. Okay, so people think now that the government has to take care of them. People. Now, I'm not talking about even states. But how many times have you heard of Congress saying, I'm going to get $200 million for that bridge in my district? Wait a minute. It's a state bridge. Why are we paying federal money to do that, right? And why? Because Congress needs to get votes. And they're using the violation of our Constitution to actually get elected again. Okay.
They knew what they were doing when they started giving citizens money, government money. And when you have like a huge like behemoth that we have in this country at the state and federal level, where over, I think it's now over 50% of the people like work for the government. Some yeah. government, you know, they're getting a paycheck from a local government or a federal government. Then they're not going to step up or stand up and say, oh yeah, this agency is not very effective. We don't do our job. We need to be shut down, because they don't want to lose their income. You know, so it got really sticky. You know, it's a very sticky kind of situation. And a lot of people that work in these, you know, like you're in business for yourself. I'm in business for myself. I know my business from soup to nuts. I know what happens, what, you know, like I know the whole continuum of providing the services that I provide, the products, everything. If you work at a government agency and you're just pushing paper, you're making sure this document got signed by so-and-so and passed on to such and such, then you don't even know what you're doing. You don't know
there's a business principle here with government. Whenever there lacks competition, quality goes down the tubes. You're not looked at as a taxpayer. You're not looked at as a customer of the government. You're not. Matter of fact, you got to remember the Constitution is a limit on the government, but the way it's now turned out is the limitations are coming from the government on us, and the bureaucrats that run the government do not view you as a quote unquote customer of the government, okay, or who pays their salaries or whatever. And by the way, there was a case, U.S. versus Butler, which mm-hmm. basically said that, and I won't get into the ins and out of the case, but the way this was decided. And I think the dissenting opinion was Justice Owen J. Roberts. It basically gave Congress unlimited interpretation about what general welfare meant. Okay, so in other words, you got the enumerated powers.
Yeah.
That's it. You're the laws that you could write, but when it comes to spending money, Congress can deem anything they basically want, and that's how this has, and more in line with the Hamiltonian position on the federal government versus Monroe, who, by the way, wrote the Constitution, Madison, and Jefferson, okay? And so here's the question you have to ponder now. Okay, if you've got Congress who can say, look, they've basically got unlimited powers to spend money on what they think we need, okay? Well, and we're running up our national debt, and we're economically burying this country. I mean, just look at what happened in the last 3 or 4 years with Biden printing money, which expands the money supply, which is the cause of inflation. That is the definition, right? We talked about that in previous episodes.
And then anger, not to interrupt, but while we're printing away and we have this debt-based economy, we're angering the people we borrow money from and do business with.
Yeah. Don't even get me going.
Threatening to steal money. You know, the Russians right now, there's something like $300 billion in Russian assets in American banks. And this government is up nights trying to figure out how they can take that money and give it to Ukraine and launder it through Ukraine. And
hey, by the way, we still give funding to China. We give federal aid to China. We give federal aid to Russia. We said this on a prior podcast with the Robert Welch thing. The countries that we give aid to is astonishing. But here's a question for you. So if you've got Congress with unlimited spending power,
yep,
because these wise individuals are determining what is good for our welfare, our general welfare, how is spending ourselves into debt good for our general welfare? Think about that.
Well, James Madison in 1792 responded to the tax and spend notion of Congress, that they could just, whatever we needed, they could tax and spend. And he said, if Congress can do that, ever in their do whatever is in their discretion can be done by money and will promote the general welfare, the government is no longer a limited one.
Right.
Possessing enumerated powers, but an indefinite one subject to particular exceptions. So they can do anything they want, except for maybe X, Y, or Z.
Well, you see the spending though in that.
That's where we are.
Yeah. And what he's talking about here is that, you know, this whole notion of general welfare, which is in the first article, section 8, article 1, section 8, saying that you're not bound to those 18, you're not bound to those 18 enumerated powers. You could do whatever you want, basically. Okay. So his point is right on the money. How is this a limited government then if you've got carte blanche checkbook to do whatever you want?
It's not. And the problem ends up, and this is what we're facing today, is a debt that is not serviceable.
No.
Every time, I just listened to Rand Paul did a little thing on Forbes. They do these clips. And he was saying that all the money collected in taxes last year will pay for Medicare, Social Security, and a couple other what they call entitlements. Now, everybody needs to understand that entitlements are things that we've actually paid for. So when you get Social Security, which you paid through a tax.
Thank you, government. I'm entitled for getting my money back, maybe.
But what's interesting about that is that you're taxed on it again. So once you start collecting your Social Security.
Thank you, Bill Clinton. And
that
Gore.
Was a tax.
Yes.
Going to get taxed on it again. So it's not a sustainable system, I guess, is where what I'm saying.
Well, and why you didn't earn any interest on it either. So
so here we are in this day and age. I was just in Long Beach, California, where a gallon of premium gasoline costs $5 and I think it was 59 cents if you belong to the little club at the Sinclair station. You got 10, it was 59, but actually it was $5.69 a gallon. And
no, you know, I know California is higher because they have higher taxes. Do you know here in Scottsdale, Suzette, the highest I paid for premium, because my car takes premium, was $6.79. Okay. Now, right here in Scottsdale, Arizona. Okay. Now, we have a little bit of a problem in terms of transporting oil here. But anyway, that's, I mean, come on. I was paying $2.40, I think, when Trump left office. Okay. Until this guy took over. But okay. So enough with that. The bottom line on this, Suzette, to your point, is are we really working in the best interest or general welfare, if you want to use that word, of our nation? When, you know, and I think it was Jefferson, I think, that said something to the effect, and I'll have to get this quote, and I'll look it up here, but the government is, you know, in the kind of like the fraud, if you will, of them taking care of us. They're not taking care of us, right? They're actually
bankrupting American families. It costs at least $100 a week to feed one person in this country if you're eating normal food. And by normal food, I mean fruits, vegetables, whole grains, some meat, you know, dairy, the kinds of things that most Americans would eat. $100 a week. If you have a teenage son, you can make that $150. If you have three teenage sons, I mean, you're flat broke. You're spending $400 or $500 a week. This is what most families are faced with right now. And it's an unbelievable situation for the government to have put us in. And a lot of people don't understand, you know, that inflation, when you start printing money, the people that get the money first can have the highest value of that money. So they can buy more with that money than the guy that gets that money 18 months, 2 years, 3 years down the road.
By the way, now, you know who the guy gets it first? The Federal Reserve.
That's right.
And I heard a pundit the other day, and I could have killed him. He says, well, you know, it's an independent agency. It's not a government agency. No, it's not a government agency, but who do you think appoints all the heads of those banks? The president. Okay. So don't give me that crap. It's not a, you know, it has the same effect of being that. Right.
Well, and that's going to be an interesting conversation that we have about.
Oh, that is going to, we're going to do multiple Federal Reserve episodes. Hey, by the way, I found the quote. Jefferson said, I predict future happiness for Americans if they can prevent the government from wasting the labors of the people under the pretense of taking care of them. Bring it. That's what's going on.
There's nothing. Yes, these men really understood a lot about the world.
My God,
I mean,
yeah.
They were well read. They were reading things in Latin and Greek. These are not new ideas. You know, like we think, oh, we're all sophisticated and we all know so much. And, you know, we do have access to a lot of information. There's no question about that. It can be overwhelming. But these men understood, you know, the triumphs and the failures of governments and civilizations over millennia.
You know, Suzette, I've said this about this, what you just said about information. We have more information at our fingertips right now than any other time in human history. Matter of fact, in my little iPhone I have, right? But we are probably the least informed at this point in our lives. Okay.
I think the average American watches 7 hours of Netflix a day.
Yeah, well.
It's like a job.
God bless them. Okay, let's move on.
Anyway, okay.
With the take care clause. This is going to be a fun one for you.
Okay.
What is the take care clause? Article 2 has all to do with the executive branch. And for those of you and Rhea Linda, that is the president. Okay. I have to go back to Rush Limbaugh again. boy, do I miss him.
I was thinking about that while I was driving from California. Rhea Linda, you cracked me up. Anyway, sorry.
I have a cousin that lives north of Rhea Linda, and he says to me, how do you guys know about Rhea Linda? I go, listen to Rush Limbaugh. Anyway,
So the take care clause.
Take care clause. Article 2, section 3. Okay. And I'm just going to read part of it here. The president, I guess they weren't assuming a she back then, shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States. So basically it says the president must enforce laws. This is not up for debate. This is not up for, hey, I think I'm going to enforce that law, but not that law because I don't like it. Okay, that's what this clause means.
It's the executive's function. The executive function of the president is to make sure that everyone's doing their job and that the job is being done well, period. So he has to know what the job is. He has to understand the Constitution. He has to understand the limited powers of the government. And he has to make sure that everyone is doing what they're supposed to do, period. And there, and that clearly isn't happening. We now have, from what best I can tell, government by committee, because our current president is clearly not, what is it? There's a medical name for not being mentally sound, but he is not mentally sound. It's obvious to anyone.
Well, look, you don't have
to be a psychiatrist.
I don't even think it's that. I think it has to do, this is intentional. Okay. And it goes back to globalism and all the other things that you and I talked about offline, you know,
right.
It really does. I don't think any of this is by accident. You know, Suzette, just to depart here for a minute, and maybe we should talk about this on another episode, but I really thought about the American people. And when I ran for Congress, I saw their pain firsthand. And I got to talk to a lot of people, and they were desperate. They were saying to me, Mark, help us. What are we going to do? Right. And are you the guy that's going to help me? Right. Well, I came to the conclusion, three things. There is, besides the benefit to the American people, there is no benefit in peace. There is no benefit for a healthy America, and there is no benefit for a limited government. Besides, all those three things will only benefit the American people, but the people running the show, no. I don't care if you talk about pharmaceuticals, doctors, not all doctors, of course. If you want to talk about the military industrial complex, which I talked about in a previous episode, if you want to talk about the fourth branch of government, all these ABC agencies, right? Where, by the way, this take care clause, Congress, you know, as we talked about there, they basically say, okay, well, we're going to pass a broad law. We're going to establish an agency and give it to the agency, and they'll reinforce the law. Okay, well, now these regulations that get set in these agencies are dictated by the executive branch, because that's where these agencies fall under. Because he's supposed to implement the law. All right, got that. But now they can write regulations with very broad laws that have the power of law. So these regulations could take your house away. They could take your car away. They can fine you. Okay. Which basically means, in some sense, the president is writing law, because these broad powers, Congress doesn't have the guts to be specific about some of these laws. And they, you know, and they hand them over to some bureaucrats that you don't even know, and you'll never know, and you'll never get to talk to, okay? And the president is the one that writes these laws. And I talked all about this on that fourth branch episode, all right? So this take care clause gets, like a lot of things, gets abused. But let's just talk about Title 8. President Trump was called a racist for enforcing our immigration laws, which is Title 8. Okay, we've talked about Title 42, but Title 8 is the law as to how we should process, allow people into this country. Okay, well, President Biden right now is absolutely ignoring Title 8, and he is not in concert with the Take Care Clause, which is Article 2, Section 3. So now that it's election time, all of these congressmen are coming out wanting to impeach him, and Mayorkas just got articles of impeachment and passed the House. And it's like, where were you guys like 3 years ago? Okay. Where were you 3 years ago? Oh yeah, I forgot. It's election time, right? So this whole thing's a game to these people, okay, in my opinion. And then, you know, so now you say, all right, well, can a president not enforce a law that he thinks is unconstitutional? All right. Well, it's an interesting thing because Jefferson did it with the Alien Sedition Act. When John Adams wanted to make it illegal to write about or criticize the government. And Jefferson said, no, we're pushing back on you. We're not doing it. Okay. So now the question is, what do you do there? This is a big dilemma. Okay. You've heard Biden say that. You heard Obama say, if Congress doesn't take action, he said this at State of the Union, I have a phone and I have a pen. Basically, that means he's going to write an executive order to write law. Okay. And nobody had a problem with that. It was like, really? Wow. So this is a very interesting part of this. And then the question is, how do you prioritize what laws you're going to enforce?
Well, there's that. That's what I was going to say. Like they can have the law, but I believe sheriffs. And you know Sheriff Joe personally. I can't wait.
Yes, I do. Good friend of mine. Yes, I do.
And he would be a great person to talk about this. But sheriffs have, as I understand it, their job is to enforce the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what, and they I could be wrong about this.
No, you're not. They all take the oath. They all take the oath. They are legislators, by the way.
So that's a primary thing for them. So if a sheriff's department doesn't want to enforce a law, like say a mask mandate, which isn't a law, but people are, you know, during that whole mess, we know that a lot of people had, especially children in school, which is a government building, right? So if I have a restaurant and I want people to wear a mask, that's my right. It's my private property.
It's your restaurant.
It's my restaurant. I can say that, wear a mask, you know, wear a shirt, wear shoes. But if I'm a school that's getting federal funding, I cannot do that. And if I'm a sheriff, I don't have to enforce that. So how does the sheriff know that a child is being like cast out? You know, or being like, we saw a horrible video of children being yelled at by teachers, you know, and these are like asthmatics. We have very sick children long before COVID, you know, over 50% of American children are chronically ill and they take medication. Many of them have allergies, asthma, that kind of thing. And wearing a mask is like a death sentence to them. They can't breathe, you know? So, you know, a sheriff. So choosing to enforce a law or a mandate is really
the interesting thing is those weren't laws. You know, here's the thing.
Right.
When Biden said laws. every public transportation, you have to wear a mask. He did that through executive order. That's not a law. And oh yeah, by the way, I don't think these congressmen would ever pass a law like that because we kicked their butts out of office.
Yeah, see, and this is the thing, but the propaganda is so powerful that they had people on TV telling you that if you didn't wear a mask, you were going to kill Granny. And if, you know, so you were a really bad person if you didn't wear
a mask. And when they told me that, you know what, my grandparents are gone, so that couldn't have killed them. Anyway.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying, you know, like,
let me tell you. I had some crazy things happen to me with COVID. I had people, a lady standing right next to me on a Hertz rental car bus, packed like sardines, telling me to put my mask on. And I asked her, well, then you got to give me 6 feet social distancing because she couldn't go anywhere. She was, you know. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So this take care clause, you know, it gets violated all the time. Okay.
Yes.
And we're not, the president is not enforcing the laws, and that is his number one job. Okay. In addition to being commander in chief.
And without killing the, you know, beating the dead horse, so to speak, if the president were just doing his executive function, keeping us safe, maintaining our borders, maintaining sound money, then a lot of these other problems wouldn't be here. They're here because care was not taken.
Suzette, what do we say in our preamble of this this podcast every time we go on? If we follow the Constitution, that's why we call this the Constitution Solution. Follow the darn Constitution and most of these problems go away. But you know what? When you follow this Constitution, a lot of people are going to lose money. Okay, and that's the deal.
Okay? They might in
you won't as an American. Americans won't. The people in power will.
Right, because we would be making more money.
Right.
You know, if you had a really free economy, where an economy where ideas flowed, and sorry about that.
Yeah, I mean, Adam Smith, we don't follow the Adam Smith economy because we regulate the hell out of it.
We really don't. And we don't follow the Constitution. And that's why we have a lot of the problems that we have.
But that's why we have this podcast. We want to educate people because, you know, there's another quote in here I'll find sooner or later that says that, here it is. if a nation expects, this is Jefferson, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. Okay. And you know, we have to have a well-informed citizenry because we are just so ill-informed at all. And it's just incredible how there's one other one in here too. I can't find it right now, but, and then Franklin says, it is the responsibility of every citizen to question authority. Well, then you've got to be somewhat educated on some of these matters in order to do that. And we're just not as a nation. And a lot of that, I look at our school system. Look, okay, I got two more to go. Establishment and free exercise clause, okay? So Suzette, the First Amendment, okay, says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Okay, so what I want to talk about here is more the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause of religion. So basically what this is saying is that the government can't write a law to establish religion, because you got to remember, people left initially for being persecuted back in 1600 when they came over initially on the Mayflower and all that for religious pure purposes, right? You were mandated in England to follow a certain religion and a certain set
Church
of laws.
Church of England.
The Church of England, okay?
You had to worship the king.
Worship the king.
The king would talk about the Holy Week, him and Jesus, or her, you know, the queen, her and Jesus. I mean, these are really delusional people. They thought they were like it. They thought they were on equal footing with Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Well, the good news is our government's not, because most of our leaders, at least today, don't believe in Jesus Christ. Anyway, I digress.
I'm just saying, you know, the Church of
Marxism
England
doesn't believe in God, so they're atheists. But here's the thing. It not only forbids the government from establishing any religion, but also prohibits the government actions that unduly favor one over another, okay? It prohibits the government from unduly preferring religion over non-religion or non-religion over religion. Okay, great. Now, what happened here with this whole business about, you've heard it, separation of church and state, right? That came out of in 1947, Justice Hugo Black used that basically said, you know, in one way or the other, that this clause or this First Amendment transcends to states too. States cannot prohibit you because, again, go back to the Supremacy Clause. This is the law of the land, right? They can't allow you to not establish a religion or regulate your religion from the state level because of the First Amendment. Okay. But one what he did, what Justice Hugo Black did, was invoke a line in a letter that Jefferson wrote to the Baptists of Connecticut in Danbury, Connecticut, not too far where I grew up. And in that, the Baptists, who were persecuted at the time, okay, as a religion, came under a lot of scrutiny and all that. They were concerned because the Connecticut Constitution did not allow for any protection of religion. Okay. So they were afraid that they would end up becoming, you know, persecuted from the state of Connecticut. And Jefferson wrote this letter to them. And in it, he said there is a separation of church and state. Well, the people who want to eliminate religion and God from our lives used that inappropriately and took it out of context as to what Jefferson really meant by that. What he was saying is, look, the separation of church and state is because simply they can't write a law to prohibit what you're doing. Or
the government can't get involved in your religion, period.
Right.
Not in
right.
your school, not even on government property, not in your school, not in your home, not in public. The government cannot get involved in religion.
It doesn't mean that people in government can't practice religion. It doesn't mean you can't have 10 amendments on the wall. It doesn't mean you can't pray, okay, before the opening of Congress, okay? But unfortunately, this Hugo Black guy, this justice, okay, used that because he was trying, first of all, a lot of people don't know this, but it is a known fact that he was a member of the KKK. And the KKK had a unbelievable disdain for the Catholic religion, okay? And so he used this to drive a wedge and start this whole church and state stuff, okay? So now those who want to actually eliminate God from our lives, and again, this is all one big Venn diagram, Suzette, where you go back to Marxism and you go back to how they want you to worship them, like you said earlier, and not God, not a God, okay? Well, guess what? They use this church and state to say all religion have to be eliminated. We have to take crosses down to honor our war veterans when it's on federal land. That is not what this says, okay? But that's how this is now being misused, and that Jefferson quote, church and state, I'll bet you ask anybody where that quote comes from that wants to tout, you know, pulling religion out of government or God out of our lives, if you will, wouldn't even know Jefferson said it and why it was said. Okay. Anyway, that's the whole, you know, the whole business about this free exercise and establishment clause in the First Amendment.
And I'm happy it's there. Important for us to enforce it.
Yeah. Okay, and by the way, there was just one more thing on that. There was a ruling that early on allowed that actually prohibited prayer in the classroom. Okay, which is really sad. So you see that there's so many different avenues that these things take, okay, and they get interpreted differently, and some of them hold, okay, and it's just not good. It's just not good.
Well, if you have socialist and communist leanings, you of course want to eliminate Jesus Christ from the equation and God from the equation, because you want everyone to worship you. You know, the government's the, you know, has the final say in everything, not Christ. If you're following Christ, then you typically these other agencies and these other like guidelines are ridiculous. You know, they're not going to be, if they're not consistent with your faith. So I, you know.
But again, you know, as you and I have talked so many times, when you're misinformed or ill-informed about our rights, it's so easy to take them away.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
it is. And when you don't have strong personal values, when you're getting a lot of who you are from what's out there, from a culture that, especially one in decline, which I think, anyway,
we are, by the way, again, that's why we're doing this podcast, right?
Yes.
Okay. Last one.
Yay.
Okay. Eighth Amendment. There, as I said, I think earlier, there's three clauses in here. So excessive bail should not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. So there's a bail clause, an excessive fine clause, and unusual punishment clause. Okay, now I want to focus on the excessive fines. Why? It's current today. As we know, President Trump has just been fined $350 some odd million for basically doing nothing. And I don't want to mitigate that. I don't want to litigate that case here. Okay. But the thing about this is a couple things came out of this. Okay. First of all, this excessive fine clause can be traced all the way back to 2015 and the Magna Carta. Okay. And it first only applied to the federal government, but because of the Supremacy Clause and some other rulings that happened along the way, it does apply to state levels too. Now, here's what happens, okay? And by the way, the IRS is a big culprit in this one, all right? Many government agencies sidestep this protection that we have of excessive fines by relabeling these fines as a civil penalty.
Yes.
Got that?
The workaround.
Okay, yeah. So let me give you an example. There was a lady named Monica Toth who had half of her bank account, which was over $2.1 million. I don't know if that was $4.2 million, now it's millions of dollars, okay? Taken by the IRS for failing to file a one-page report, okay? The First Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals ruled that what happened to Monica wasn't a fine, but a civil penalty. And by imposing a civil penalty, the IRS could evade scrutiny under the excessive fines clause. How about that? One page. Imagine if it was two pages.
I mean, what did they have against her? Was she just, I mean, that's, she probably could not afford to defend herself. And when you're talking about this, what I think about is just in the last 2 years, now we have to remember that President Trump has been, I would say, persecuted. You know, whether you like him or don't like him, you certainly wouldn't want to have what's happened to him happen to you. And it has happened to people. And if you can't defend yourself, he spent $76 million just in the last 2 years. So this has been going on during his presidency. So for 3 years, was it all four or just 3 years, the last 3 years of his presidency, he was under attack with the whole fake Russia collusion thing. Mueller looked at every aspect of his life and his family's life to the tune of $42 million. And when he finally showed up in court, he didn't remember anything. He couldn't remember this. He was basically worthless. So $42 million worth of investigation, and they found nothing. And now they're doing this attack on him from everybody and their mother is suing him for ridiculous crime. Things that sometimes are like even that losing, taking the documents that he took. That all presidents have done that.
Well, we saw Joe Biden do the same thing. They're just making up. You know, when our justice system actually starts with the person and then looks for the crime, now we're in trouble. Okay.
And we are in trouble.
Normally, you prosecute somebody when there's a crime committed. And then you say, who did the crime?
Qui bono? Who benefits? So who's benefiting from this? when they had Trump on the front page, they were all making a lot of money. You know, CNN, Fox, all the networks made a pile of money when they were attacking Trump. And when they stopped doing it for a while, their revenues fell off and nobody's listening to them. Everybody else, everyone is that wants like news and is really like halfway.
Yeah, Trump was the best thing that happened to him. That's right.
Yeah. You know, like everybody that's halfway interested in what's really going on has found an independent news source. You know, they're just not on cable anymore. They're not. So those guys are losing money big time.
Well, let's not forget the military-industrial complex he was pushing back on, and the globalism and all the things going on with that. He took a lot of money out of people's piggy banks in a lot of ways, not just the press, okay? And that's why they're going after him. And and there's a lot of evidence now that says JFK was killed by the CIA and by Lyndon Johnson. Because, you know, first of all, Lyndon Johnson had unbelievable investments in Bell Helicopter and some of the other big defense companies. He profited big time by Vietnam and lied to us about the Bay of Tonkin and lied to Congress. And sure enough, 58,000 bodies later, okay, and so much other injuries and suicides, he profited. But that's why Kennedy's not here today. And there's a lot of evidence now to suggest that. So that's why they're going after Trump. Okay.
And now, I just want to throw in, and I know this is a little off the point, but when we go to war and we lose 58,000 men like we did in Vietnam, you lose at least twice that many in civilian deaths.
Yep.
So you totally wipe out, you know, cultures. I mean, the brutality of this for money speaks to an inhumanity that is.
Well, as you know, I lost my son in Afghanistan, and I've seen firsthand what it does to families. Okay. And
yes.
And by the way, we made out much better for a lot of different reasons than some other Gold Star families that we know. Devastated. Right. Still today, you know, 15 years later. So, yeah. And that's irreparable. That they don't care about that. Okay.
No,
well, let me give you a couple cases here, Suzette. Okay. So we talked about this one lady with the 2.1 million, right? Cause she didn't file paid with the IRS, and they renamed it a civil penalty and the court held it up. All these excessive fines have been going on since, as I say, Custer was a private. Okay. All right. And the first time, believe it or not, that I use that a lot, by the way. The Supreme Court, believe it or not, the first time that they pushed back on this and enforced this excessive fine clause was 1998. Okay. And in this, I'm going to say this guy's name wrong, United States versus, Jackian, I think, I don't know, ruled against the federal government for trying to take $357,144 from him because he failed to report that he was taking money out of the country. Okay, now, and Justice Thomas, Clarence Thomas, wrote the defining opinion here, which I think he's brilliant, by the way. The failure to report this money, the fine was $5,000, but they charged him $357,144. So basically, you know, Clarence Thomas was able to do some very basic math and say, that's larger than $5,000. Okay. And so, many orders of magnitude, as a matter of fact, he said in his opinion, so they ruled that was grossly disproportionate to the gravity of the offense, okay, and it violated the excessive fines clause. So he won. Now, who the heck, to your point earlier, knows how much this guy spent in legal fees to get that back? Okay,
if you don't have the legal fees, if you can't afford it, you're done. And this, and yep. the system, the court system, unfortunately, is very wealthy. It's very wealthy.
Yeah.
And I just had a friend that went through a 4.5 year divorce. Okay.
Wow.
Took 4.5 years.
Wow.
3 kids. She won custody. She just got her divorce like last week. It cost $2 million.
Yeah. So you know who won on that one, right?
She won. Because
no, the lawyers.
Oh, the lawyers. Yeah, she won, but look what it costs. I mean, it was you know, if there wasn't so much at stake in terms of protecting the children, that was the whole thing here was to protect the children from.
Yeah, well, again, these legal fees, as you said with President Trump, $74 million and county, and by the way, it's still ticking. That's going to go up.
I don't know. I bring that up just because, you know.
No, I know. And by the way, that legal system is used as a weapon, okay? They'll bankrupt you. They did it to General, I forget his name now, Mathis, okay? These guys, right?
And this Peter Navarro is going in jail.
Well, I don't understand that one because Peter Navarro appealed his 4-month sentence, and the judge says, well, you still have to report to jail. It's going to take more than 4 months to do the appeal.
This is a man who was a college professor.
Talk to me about that. Yeah.
And came to Washington and did some really good things.
I have his book on my China shelf. Over there. All those books in the middle shelf behind me are in China. And let me do another one.
Okay.
A guy named Tyson Timbs had his $42,000 Land Rover seized and forfeited over a minor drug crime. And again, you were talking about drug crimes earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
Indiana Supreme Court firmly rejected the state's argument. If the property was an instrument of the crime, the state said, then its forfeiture is not excessive. And the Supreme Court in Indiana said, nope, sorry, that doesn't count. Sorry, you can't make that call. That's an excessive fine. And they cited the Eighth Amendment as a violation. And they said, the factors you have to include are the harshness of the punishment, the severity of the underlying offense, which in this case was minor, and the economic offense a fine would have on the punished individual. However, to hold the opposite would generate a new fiction. The court ruled that taking away the same piece of property from a billionaire and from someone who owns nothing else punishes each person equally. So this whole crap about, well, he can afford it. We could take $72 million from him because he's a billionaire. No, they said, no. You take $1 from a billionaire or $1 from a guy, you know, sweeping the streets, it's the same penalty. That's what they said.
Equal treatment under the law.
I agree that. Yes. Okay. So, now where does this lead us? Well, unfortunately, I got a bad story for you. In 2022, the 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals ruled against a guy named Jim.
Do we know where the 11th Circuit is?
I don't know where it is. Is it down south? I don't know.
I'll look real quick.
Yeah, look it up for me. Ahead. Yeah, I'm guessing it's down south. I think it's down south, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
Ruled against a guy named Jim Finken, who was fined nearly $30,000. You're going to love this one now. By the way, I'm in the middle of my HOA. I'm doing some, I'm causing World War III here in my neighborhood. We got some political tyrants here that are running this thing, power hungry. He was fined $30,000 by the city of Dundren, Florida. Simply, you ready for this? For letting his grass grow too long. $30,000, okay? Even though the court acknowledged that repeatedly having overgrown grass is not particularly harmful, it still declared that the fine was not excessive, okay? Since they can fine the homeowner $500 per day for tall grass, merely compounding those fines over time was completely constitutional in the eyes of the 11th Circuit. And no further analysis required. Now, this court got taken to the Supreme Court, and they decided not to hear this case. The only jurist that wanted to hear this was Gorch, Justice Gorch. He wanted to hear it, but everybody else said no. And I don't know why. Okay. So you see, this is still happening. This abuse is still happening, Suzette. And
here's the thing that's really crazy to me. For the 11th Circuit is Atlanta, Georgia. So you're right.
I was right. It was the South. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a kid on YouTube. He has a YouTube channel and he goes around and he cleans up people's yards for nothing. You know, like he'll be driving through a neighborhood and if he sees like a totally rundown place, he'll stop and ask. And sure. If it's abandoned, he'll just do it. He just cleans it up. And these are big, sometimes these are really big jobs. So you have to ask yourself, you know, like when I see your stuff like that, like, wouldn't it be great if there were like networks in place that could help people like that? That could just go over and
Look, I'm not here to solve people's grass problems. All I'm saying is that this guy.
Oh, I know. I understand that.
$30,000 for not cutting his grass? Are you kidding me?
Well, I'm talking about my workaround.
Once this happens, you just open up the candy store for these people to come in and further abuse you on your garage door or on some light that was out or it's too bright.
Right. I totally get it. Who said
and that's the point here.
Was that a city thing, I wonder?
Yeah, it was a city of some city in Florida. Yeah, it was. I said the name. What was it again?
You did.
Yeah, it was Dunedin, 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 Florida. I guess they don't like to have, first of all, grass in Florida is a good thing, isn't it? Anyway,
think so.
Suzette, look, we just covered five of these, right? Five or six, whatever it was. And there's so much more to talk about in each and every one of these, but there's also so many other clauses that we're going to do. So let's call this the constitutional clauses part one.
Part one.
Not sure you and I are going to come back and do a number more later.
Yes.
And we'll leave it at that right now. I don't know. You know, I'm looking at these things and, you know, we are continuing to deviate. But again, if Americans do not understand their rights and understand some of the history here, you know, one of the great things that the founders did, they went back in the history of time and found out what happened to the Greek Empire, what happened to the Roman Empire. We are killing history now. We're killing history.
This is so, and it's not by accident. You know, absolutely. The people that are, you know, the United States of America was ripe for the picking for tyrants. They just thought, free for all. And and many of them have shown up in all stripes, you know, now fighting amongst themselves and trying to tear our country apart. By the way,
you know, you go back and look at the Constitution is not being taught. Glastonbury, Connecticut, and I'll say it, I don't care, where my kids went to school. I was the chairman of the Republican Party in that town. And I think I was one of the two or three conservatives in the whole town. Anyway, their school curriculum, and by the way, this school, this Glastonbury High School, where both my boys graduated from, matter of fact, Laura Ingram graduated from Glastonbury High School.
Oh, cool.
Pats himself on the back of being such a brilliant school. Okay. Their political science course does not teach the Constitution. The Constitution is nowhere to be found, and the word republic nowhere to be found. They're teaching these kids that we're a democracy. Okay. And so I've written several articles to the editor talking about this, saying, hey, guys, wake up. Okay. What are you guys doing here? But, you know, when we start teaching people that we're a democracy, that's mob rule, and your opinion now counts, not what you invest in your representatives. And that there's a problem there, too. Don't get me wrong. Okay. But we just are deviating from what it is that we're doing. Again, why are we doing this podcast? This is exactly why we're doing it. Okay. So Last word, Suzette?
I think that's a wrap. Okay. You know, very interesting points that you bring up. And they bring us back to what is constitutionally sound. And that can only be good, Mark. Thanks. That was great.
Well, let's continue. We got to keep fighting here, kiddo. So you're up in Sedona, which is a little bit cooler than it is down here in Scottsdale. I see you have a sweater on. I'm in my golf shorts and my golf shirt, just to let you know. Okay.
I see you show off. It's a beautiful, it is a beautiful day here today.
It is nice. Yeah. It's nice
it's
all
a
over.
Little chilly. It is, it's 60 degrees.
Okay. I'm not going to tell you what it is here. Okay.
Oh, I think I have Phoenix on my
phone. You'll just get mad at me. That's all. That's what
is
will
it
happen.
70?
Oh, come on. I can't tell you that.
73. It's 73 in Phoenix. It's 40.
I'm not in Phoenix, but that's okay. I'm in Scottsdale.
Oh, close enough. Scottsdale's pretty close. Oh, is
by the way, the high today is going to be 80. Okay, just to let you know. Okay. All right. So I got it right here. If you're looking on YouTube.
My goodness. That is great. Yeah. That's lovely. Yeah, it is. Okay, I guess you are out of town and kind of in the desert. So, yeah.
All right. Okay. We'll see you next time. This was episode 18. Okay. Constitutional Clauses Part 1. And we will have many, many more of these going on down the line. Suzette Lawrence, thank you, from Sedona. Mark DeLuzio from Scottsdale, The Constitution Solution, one podcast under God. See you next time.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to The Constitution Solution, one podcast under God, where we hold that strict adherence to the Constitution is the solution to most of our country's problems.
You can find other episodes on our website at 1787solution.com, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and most other platforms. We're your hosts, Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence. Until next time, may God bless you and may God bless America.